The first book in more than a century from writer and naturalist Henry David Thoreau, next on Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Literary scholar Bradley Dean is here now to discuss his edition of Henry Thoreau's Faith in a Seed.
Though I do not believe that a plant will spring up where no seed has been, I have great faith in a seed. Convince me that you have a seed there, and I am prepared to expect wonders.
Literary scholar Bradley Dean reading from his edition of Faith in a Seed, the first publication in more than a century from the American writer Henry David Thoreau. Bradley Dean will be back in just a moment to talk about his work as a literary scholar. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center. Partial support for this program comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. The American writer Henry David Thoreau is probably best known for Walden, his account of life in the woods in 19th century New England. But much of Thoreau's writing was unpublished when he died. For example, he left one manuscript entitled The Dispersion of Seeds, a work that combined the perspectives of scientist, philosopher, and environmentalist. Under the title Faith in a Seed, that work was recently published under the editorship of Bradley Dean, an adjunct professor at East Carolina University, who is also secretary of the Thoreau Society. Bradley Dean is here now to talk about the first of Henry Thoreau's books to be published in more than 125 years. In language that recalls Thoreau's attention to the classical sources that inspired both his scientific and literary imagination, Bradley Dean reads now from the opening passage of Faith in a Seed.
Pliny, whose work embodies the natural science of his time, tells us that some trees bear no seed. The only ones, says he, among the trees that bear nothing whatever, not so much as any seed even, are the tamarisk, which is used only for making brooms, the poplar, the Atinian elm, and the alaternus. And he adds that these trees are regarded as sinister and are considered inauspicious.
Bradley Dean, welcome to the National Humanities Center. Let's talk about Henry David Thoreau. Is this man a scientist? Is he a philosopher? Is he an environmental prophet? We've got a lot of categories we could put him into, right?
I think first and foremost, he must be regarded as an author, a writer. A writer with very strong environmental interests, what we now would term as environmental interest, a very clear interest in natural history. A writer who had some interest, a great deal of interest in what we now would probably call moral philosophy, although for him it was just the issue of how to live in his time. He had to deal, for instance, with issues of slavery and taxation. Of course, civil disobedience grew out of that. But I would say a philosopher in the sense of a man who wanted both to be wise and to bring wisdom to bear on daily life. That's basically the first chapter of Walden. He's insistent on theorizing, but then putting his theories into practice with experience.
Do you call him an environmental prophet, Brad Dean?
I think we have to call him an environmental prophet. Virtually every natural history writer nowadays harkens back at one level or another, to Thoreau as the seminal writer in their particular field.
Let's talk about Faith in a Seed, this manuscript that you have edited, and place Henry David Thoreau in the circumstances of 19th century science. It's very pleasing to us to call him an environmental prophet, and but let's go back and understand him on his own terms. What kind of a scientist was he? What kind of marks do you give him?
I would say there were That was the period of time where there began to be professional scientists. But it was also the time that professional scientists were just coming into being at that time, specialists in particular branches of science. Thoreau was one of the earlier generation, for instance, Goethe, the famous German writer, who was kind of a Renaissance man in the sense that he didn't have a specialty. He ranged through the entire spectrum of human knowledge, you might say, with a very strong interest in what we now call science. They called it natural history back then. Right. Interestingly enough, Darwin himself did not want to be called a scientist. He wanted to be called a natural historian. And for them, that was a distinction with a very critical difference. Probably the single biggest difference between what we now call science and natural history, what they called natural history, is the subjective element in their science.
And you argue that that's a good thing, that that's something that we really need to recognize or reinfuse into our understanding of science today.
Right, right. There are many, many debates in the academic communities and the professional communities about this very subject. What happens, and you can cite various historical facts, when you take the humanism out of science, you basically get, you might say, robots. Now, the difficulty is how do you remain a human being and still perform good science?
Uh-huh.
And Thoreau was interested in that, I think, to some extent, but for him it wasn't as focused an issue as it is for us nowadays.
Now, as a scientist, here's a guy who decided that he was going to look at what? A thumbnail. He was going to look at a sort of a postage stamp.
Right.
In other words, his own local circumstances.
Right.
And attempt the grand plan of understanding the natural world, generalizing from that experience.
Right.
Again, let's put him in the circumstances of 19th century science. He gets into something of an argument with a famous Harvard biologist about how the world regenerates itself. Tell me about that.
Right. Well, this, again, he was particularly active in scientific circles throughout the 1850s and into the 1860s. He died in 1862. The obvious bombshell for the intellectual period was Darwin's On the Origin of Species, which was published in, I think it was November of 1859, which was right in the middle of this whole period that Thoreau had become very interested in science throughout the 1840s, and then began putting some what he called system to his science in the early 1850s.
Hmm.
Agassiz was probably the single most, Louis Agassiz, the Harvard botanist, was the single most important scientist at the time in the United States. Very, very popular, very well regarded. He came from Europe and had that to his benefit,
uh-huh.
The whole mystique of coming from Europe.
And what did he represent as a scientist? I mean, there are two sort of polar positions here represented by Agassiz and Thoreau.
Right. The one position was the traditional position of botanists and scientists at the time, that nature goes through a series of, in other words, we account for the phenomena in our experience, for instance, glacial phenomena and those sorts of things that we can see in the landscape. We account for those in, nowadays, one way, but back then in a totally different way, and they called it special creation.
Right.
In other words, God came down and created something. And then he came, you know, like with the probably the best known instance is the Noah's flood, where everything is wiped out, and then he started over again. This was a huge debate at the time, very important, very critical. Arguments were being tossed all about by scientists at the time. And what was at issue here was basically what we now term evolution, and this conflict, I might add, is still going on today.
Absolutely. Right. And Thoreau comes along and basically takes the Darwinian position.
Exactly. Before Darwin.
Uh-huh.
One of the things that we have to keep in mind here, it's been a lot of people have said that Thoreau is just picking up where Darwin, not necessarily left off, but he's basically supplementing Darwin's argument on the origin of species, because this book, or he was writing on this manuscript in 1860, which is about a year after On the Origin of Species was published. It's easy to say that Thoreau got his entire argument from Darwin and was just applying Darwin's theories to a specific location, in other words, Concord, Massachusetts.
Well, that's also unfair to Thoreau to say that.
Exactly, because his theories on, for instance, the phenomenon of succession of forest trees, he articulated that theory in 1856, 3 years before On the Origin of Species came out. So Thoreau had his own observations and was obviously up on all of the current literature that was going on, and was able to actively participate in the debate.
Let's talk about Henry David Thoreau and this book that you have, this manuscript that you have edited, Brad Dean, Faith in a Seed. Let's talk about it in terms of the literary culture that Thoreau inhabited. He was friends with Ralph Waldo Emerson.
Mm-hmm.
The argument went that if you knew nature, you knew yourself. Was that a kind of a conscious thing on his part? Was he what we now call a transcendentalist?
Well, he spoke of himself as a transcendentalist, whatever that means. He said, "I am a mystic, a naturalist, and a transcendentalist to boot." in a journal passage that he wrote in 1856, again right around the time that he was articulating his theory of the succession of forest trees. But again, I think he regarded himself primarily as a writer. He clearly grew up in a socio-cultural environment where Emerson was key to his early development. Thoreau graduated from Harvard in 1837. Emerson, while Thoreau was away at Harvard, Emerson moved into Thoreau's hometown of Concord. So when he came back, Emerson was there.
Uh-huh. They lived with, if not as neighbors, they lived in one another's houses, wasn't that it? Or right. Thoreau and Emerson's house?
Right. Emerson became quite popular lecturer at the time, and in one case, for instance, went to England on a lecture tour, extended lecture tour, and Thoreau was asked to come in and work as a handyman around the household.
Now, let me take you back to this argument, this relationship between literature and science. The mm-hmm. the argument is that if you know nature, then you know yourself. That is not, I take it, on Thoreau's part, just a sort of fancy literary kind of emblem. I mean, he really believed this. He had a passionate scientific as well as philosophical notion that one kind of knowledge more or less equated with the other. Am I on the right track?
I believe so. It's a very difficult. I mean, he has so many journal passages where he over the period of years where he's discussing this issue that it's difficult to generalize about something like that. His relationship with nature was a very sophisticated relationship, a very complex relationship. But I think in general, that's true. Thoreau, for instance, when he was on top of Mount Katahdin in Maine, had the landscape affected him in a way that basically he felt totally alienated from his own body as a physical part of nature.
And wait a minute, what we call out-of-body experience, is that too much of a stretch?
I think that's too much of a stretch. What he basically realized, or what the form of nature he saw on top of Mount Katahdin, a very raw, wild, alienating form of nature, what it made him realize was, as he says at the end of a critical passage in italics, he writes in italics, "Who are we? Where are we?" And those are very simple but very, very complicated and very serious questions. Who are we? He basically implies in this passage that we are spirit, but we are also spirit attached to matter. In other words, we're spirits, embodied spirits, you might say. And that incident, or the mere being up there on top of Mount Katahdin, forced him to realize that. And again, it was kind of an alienating experience. He went to nature, raw nature, unmediated nature, or he calls it unhandled nature. In other words, man has no relation to this kind of nature. And it makes him realize what man really is, because the body obviously has a very clear relation to that particular kind of nature.
Didn't he see himself as, he referred emblematically to himself as a white poplar or a tree sort of standing alone on a hill? Is that an accurate description after, you know, I mean, you've been through this man's life and work, you know it intimately. Mm-hmm. Is that fanciful language?
It's fanciful to some extent. He made two remarks to both, I believe, to his friend William Ellery Channing, a walking companion. One, he said that the white pine standing on a ridge by itself was an emblem of my life. Uh-huh. He also mentioned to Channing at another time that if after his death, he didn't say anything about an autopsy, but basically he said, after my death, you will find scrub oak written on my heart. Hmm. Again, I think what it is he has such a passionate, close, almost intimate relation with these natural phenomena that he felt they came to symbolize his life. Also, white pine, you must realize at the time, the white pine was a commodity, widely regarded as a very valuable commodity by the timber interests up in Maine.
The forests had been leveled.
Right. You know, in some cases, to fill the maw, as Thoreau puts it, to fill the maw of the locomotives of the time, the steam engines that were going on, but also for paper mills and the usual, well, I guess they were not into using wood for paper at the time, but primarily for heating. But the white pine was a very precious commodity to the timber industry at the time, and they would actively go out looking for stands of white pine. So it became very, very rare.
Mm-hmm.
And the cycle for white pines is much more ecologically complex than for other species of pine. And as a consequence, Thoreau, I think, began to he pretty much saw himself as apart from his own society. He had developed different interests. And that sort of thing.
Well, let's pick up on that. We're talking here, Brad Dean, about your book, Faith in a Seed, Henry David Thoreau. Is it true that he was a misanthrope? You say that he sees himself apart from society. One of the ironies is that we look back on him today and we find in him an inspiration for personal behavior and one's relationship with nature. Mm-hmm. And yet I remember reading that that Thoreau was not a popular guy and that he didn't like his neighbors. I mean, after all, he went out and lived in the woods, not far out, but he was out there for a year or so. What about this?
Oh, that's a popular misconception, one promulgated by Thoreau himself, frankly. Thoreau was a lecturer.
He was his own best PR guy.
Exactly, or his own best antagonist in some cases. But Thoreau was a lecturer, and he regarded himself in some sense as a prophet, as a seer. And he had, as part of the dynamic of the seer and sayer, to go back to the original root meanings of those words, he went out and saw whatever it was he saw. Now, it might have been human relations, it might have been social relations, it might have been natural relations or whatever. Then based on the dynamic, he was responsible for coming back into the community and saying, in other words, interpreting what he's seen.
Well, this brought him to the positions that he took on taxes,
exactly,
on moral issues, on issues of race.
Exactly.
He wrote on behalf of John Brown, for
right.
example.
Mm-hmm.
Is it too much of a stretch to say that that is a form of environmentalism?
The John Brown piece?
Sure. I mean, in moral environment,
sure.
that kind of thing.
Well, Thoreau's environmentalism has a very, very strong moral base. There's
right.
no question about it. Thoreau believed that that nature played an integral, as a matter of fact, an essential part, and obviously it does, but it also played a part in our moral development. And that's probably one of Thoreau's strongest messages, but it's always it's under the surface of his writings.
Right.
Not always. Sometimes it's right on the surface, but usually you have to think about things. But what he would do, he would come back into the community, and He was faced, obviously, with rhetorical problems. How do you bring these, in some cases, extreme statements? Some people call them ne plus ultra. this is very kind of an odd point of view. How do you get people to consider it? And one of the ways Thoreau did it, and many other lecturers of the time would come out and flatter the audience and entertain the audience, Thoreau's tack was to provoke the audience. And many times he would set himself up in an antagonistic relationship with his audience to try to provoke his audience to think about these issues. And as a consequence, he's left himself with this rhetorical legacy, which I believe is largely rhetorical, of a misanthrope. When in fact, it's always pleasant to point out that when Thoreau died, the entire town of Concord turned out for his funerals. All of the schools closed down, and all the school children went to his funeral.
Well, there's a story that, to affirm his gentleness and the sweetness of his disposition, that who was it? Somebody that is on his deathbed, he was dying, said, "Have you made your peace with God?"
Right.
And what was his answer?
I was not aware that we had quarreled.
That's marvelous. That's a wonderful line.
Yeah, he has some of the best laughs. I mean, I think he has three. Somebody said, "You're so close to the other side.
Yeah.
Can you see to the other side?" And he just said, "One world at a time."
Oh, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. Brad Dean, we're talking about Faith in a Seed, the book of Henry David Thoreau's that you have edited here. Let's discuss what you do as an editor.
Mm-hmm.
In a way, I'm tempted to ask you if you're sort of carrying on the tradition and the work, the responsibility of Henry David Thoreau in the meticulousness of what you went through in editing this manuscript. I understand, for example, that he was very organized.
Extremely.
I take it that that's the kind of thing that you went through as an editor. Tell me about it.
Right. Well, basically, manuscript editing or editing works from manuscript is, a lot of people do it today. A lot of people do it, even from handwritten manuscripts. And there's no great secret to how that should be done. There's the documentary editing profession. What I brought to this particular project was, and it was required by the project, by the way the manuscripts came down to us, I brought to this the use of physical as opposed to textual forms of evidence. And that's really my particular form of expertise.
You worked with the paper and the words themselves.
Right.
Uh-huh.
I had to do all the usual textual work. I had to find sources of Thoreau's passages in his journal, for instance, and do all the things that a normal editor would do with a manuscript that was properly sequenced. But because the manuscript was pretty dramatically out of order, I had to go back and try to find other forms of evidence in addition to textual.
Now, what you looked at the ink and the age of the ink. You looked at really minute details here in arranging these words so as to present them, to reflect the Thoreau's intentions themselves.
Right. Yeah, what is required, basically, is to use any form of evidence that you can find. I don't go with a, for instance, a preordained list or anything and say, okay, I'm going to look at the inks. What I have to do is use textual evidence as much as I can to reconstruct manuscript sequence.
Uh-huh.
Then, when there's a breakdown in the sequence, I start looking for other forms of evidence. And in fact, even the textual evidence, I like to use the physical evidence to confirm the textual evidence. But for instance, pin perforation patterns. Thoreau used in the center left margin, he would stick a straight pin to keep sheaves of leaves together.
So you looked for this physical characteristic.
Exactly. What I do is I go to the manuscript, for instance, if it has pin perforations, I automatically have a little card that I use with tracing paper window, and I trace very lightly where the pin perforations are. And basically, if Thoreau has 20 manuscripts in a sheaf, all of them pinned together, let's just make it simple. Let's just say he pinned them together once, and then he made some revisions on one sheet of paper and took the pin out and transcribed the text onto another sheet of paper, put the manuscript back in, another manuscript in the sheaf after taking one out. All 20 of those manuscripts are going to have a new pin perforation on them.
Uh-huh. So. Let's step back from some of the detailed work that you go through here, Brad Dean. Do you feel a responsibility to Thoreau's legacy, to the people who read him today? Now, I mean, that's a big leap from the sort of detail that you were just discussing.
Right.
But in a way, they act hand in hand, do they not?
It provides me with a great deal of motivation. A lot of people ask me, how in the hell is it that you can sit there and do all of this detailed work under microscopes and that sort of thing.
Yeah, well, after all, it is your scholarly reputation on the line.
Right. I have to take care of that. But I, from years ago, back in, I guess it was the mid-70s, that I was in the military and had some disciplinary problems from one perspective. But I basically was a confused kid, didn't know what I was about, and I latched on to Thoreau, whose writings impressed me a great deal. And I used those basically as a foundation to find myself. And I think many people, Thoreau himself wrote in Walden, how many a man has dated a new era in his life from the reading of a book.
Right.
And that speaks very clearly to my condition. That's exactly what happened to me, and that book was Thoreau. So I feel a very great debt to this man for waking me up. And he uses that very metaphor all throughout Walden, where he talks about himself as Chanticleer standing up to wake his neighbors up. Again, it's that provocative stance that he takes. Sometimes it can put people off. Sometimes it's exactly what you need. You need to be provoked.
Does he continue to serve that function in our American literary inheritance today?
I believe he does, but not. I think it's difficult to apply Thoreau to a social movement or something like that. They attempted that in the 60s, and what invariably you end up with is stereotypical Thoreau, application of Thoreau to stereotypes. On an individual level, you can have a very sophisticated relationship with a writer, as everyone who's read Shakespeare with any sophistication knows, or any other great writer. You get the person becomes almost the author becomes almost a mentor, and that's what Bibles are. Frankly, I mean, the Bible is not merely the King James edition. There are also people. Who was it? I guess Alexander the Great carried around the Iliad when he was around conquering the world, slept with it under his head. And for many, many people in the Thoreau Society, for instance, that's what Thoreau is to them. He's almost, he's a mentor. He's someone who provokes us to be better people, to learn how to live, to learn a more introspective and circumspective life.
Well, I got a couple of favorite lines from Henry David Thoreau. Name one of yours. Is there something that resonates that has stayed with you all these years that you've studied this man and edited his work?
Oh, there are many, many of them, but perhaps the one sentence, this is almost an aside, the one sentence that most clearly affected my life was one sentence from Life Without Principle, one
what
of his essays.
Again,
I read this when I was in the Navy on isolated duty, and the single sentence, it doesn't sound like much, but back then it seared my soul, you might say. You are paid for being something less than a man, and that really really floored me when I read that. It really hit me. And then I went on to read, of course, all of his other works and his journal on several different occasions. Probably one of the very few people in the world who has read his journals through three times.
Mike, I mean, what is it? Millions of words, right. Thousands of pages they constitute.
Right. and they're not even fully published. Most of it is published. It was published in 1906 by Houghton Mifflin. But the Princeton University Press edition of Thoreau's writings are now republishing all of the journals in a much more scholarly fashion.
Well, I want to thank you for this overview of your work. You are Bradley Dean. You're an adjunct professor at East Carolina University. You also run an international communications company. Mm-hmm. I got to tell our listeners, we're on the radio, not TV. It was great to meet you here for the first time at the Humanities Center, a Thoreau scholar in motorcycle boots. That's what I call carrying on the independent spirit. And let me mention your book. It is Faith in a Seed. You are the editor. It is available from Island Press, Shearwater Books. Can you tell me very quickly what you're working on now?
Right now I'm putting together a collection of Thoreau's natural history writings, basically to be a companion volume to this one. And then I'll be probably working on Thoreau's Wild Fruits manuscripts, which are, again, require the same kind of work to put together.
Fair enough. Brad Dean, thank you so much for coming by the National Humanities Center. I admire your work, and I wish you well in it, and I congratulate you on the publication of Faith in a Seed.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
This is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. In just a moment, I'll tell you where to write if you'd like a cassette tape of this week's show. My guest was literary scholar Bradley Dean of East Carolina University. His edition of Henry David Thoreau's Faith in a Seed was published last spring by Shearwater Books, an imprint of Island Press. Send $5 for a cassette tape of this program or $2 for a Soundings catalog. The address is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, the zip code 27709. Please ask for program number 681. That's program number 681, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, the zip code 27709. Next week, the first segment in a series of 13 programs focusing on contemporary Southern writers. Join me for readings and conversation with prize-winning writer Alan Gerganus, the author of Oldest Living Confederate Widow Tells All and White People. Until next week, at this time on this radio station, this is Wayne Pond. Partial support for this program comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.